This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. Our guests include the new LSU Law School Dean, Tom Galligan. He is with us to talk about what's happening at the Paul M. Hebert Law Center, as well as challenges facing legal eagles in Louisiana and beyond on a cold day in Louisiana. We'll go to Hammond and hear from Dane Sherman, head of the SLU Faculty Senate. Dane Sherman, of course, is a follower and blogger about American and local politics, and we'll get his take on the political winds of 2018. As budget matters threaten to shut down the federal government, and in Louisiana we face a fiscal cliff in just over 5 months. And Daniel Pink, the best-selling author, his book is When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. He says there are keys to timing our decisions and actions. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Coming in just a bit, we'll hear from Tom Galligan, who is the dean of the LSU Paul M. Hebert Law Center. We begin with Dane Sherman, who is the president of the Faculty Senate at Southeastern Louisiana University. But today he is speaking as Dane Sherman, prominent author and blogger, and certainly a follower of what's going on in our world. And good morning to you, Professor Sherman.
Hi, Jim. I'm at home today. The university's been shut down for snowpocalypse. So this is my second day home. 2.5 days I've been home. I did get out a little bit yesterday, just in my little Hamlet of Ponchatoula. Went to the post office, got a cup of coffee, and everything was it was pretty cold out there, but not too unsafe in my little town.
Well, it's a beautiful day today, and I think if we'd known it was going to be this nice, the schools would probably be open, both LSU and SLU and other schools. But they are closed today, and tomorrow's another day. But Dane Sherman, as I mentioned, you follow what's going on in our world, and many have heard you on this show, primarily as a voice from the left, on often with Scott Wilfong, who is about as far to the right as you can get in Louisiana, and that's pretty far right.
But and who is also a dear friend of mine.
Yeah, very good.
So
very good.
Listening.
He's a good man. And hopefully we'll have the two of you back soon. And Scott is in the running to be the new GOP chair. We'll see how that goes. But you at one time were a Republican, weren't you?
I was. I was Republican for quite some time. I think and I wasn't like I was involved. So if they go look up records, trust me, I paid my dues. But I paid dues for college Republicans at LSU, and to my recollection, over 20 years ago, I paid college Republican dues at Southeastern. So, but along lines of growing up, people change their political views, and mine certainly did evolve. And I'm a Democrat, but I've probably been an independent about as long as I've been a Democrat, and I do think of myself as an independent person, and try to look for solutions. I've never been a party hack or any person that's tied into the party and party line thought, and that's just something I don't believe in, or I certainly don't practice.
We have this tremendous division in American and in local politics in Louisiana, and that's evidenced by what's happening in the respective chambers on Capitol Hill and at the state capitol. We may have a budget shutdown in Washington, and in Louisiana we have a fiscal cliff in the offing, and I think most people on both sides of the aisle would say that politics contributes greatly to what's going on.
It does. It gets into I try not to let it get to much of a conflict. Sometimes it gets the best of me, but not too often. An example of this, one of the best legislators decided to resign, and that's Chris Broadwater. I think that's District 86. That's the district where I grew up. He's a Republican. I really like the guy. I think he's done a bunch of good work, and decided that he'd rather spend time with his girls growing up than at the state capitol. And so you've got three Republicans and a Democrat running in a race that's less than a month from now in February, a special election. And I'm behind one of the Republicans. I'm not behind the Democrat. I'm behind David Vial, and I think he's going to be somebody to get stuff done. And whether they're Republicans or Democrats, Jim, we have got to have people that put state and country ahead of party. And I think we are at a point where party discipline has gotten so strict and nasty that that's not happened. And I never want to be accused of somebody to put ideology or party affiliation ahead of getting something done for the state or the people of the country.
Well, yesterday, President Trump delivered his fake news awards, and two GOP senators, both from Arizona, Jeff Flake, John McCain, warned about the attacks on the media. Several Democrats joined the chorus in saying the president's attacks on a free press are undermining a fundamental tenet of democracy and emboldening people abroad who don't have the best interests of the United States at heart. So what about the president and the press right now as far as the collision that is ongoing?
Well, what I find troubling is the press created Donald Trump. I mean, he was the guy with money, but basically he is known because of his dalliances with the press. I mean, it is well established that he would be his own PR guy, calling in as a fake person to get stories in the press. He loves the press. He's a creation of the media, and so I think his attacks are serious, meaning that they're detrimental to. They're detrimental to be able to know what the truth is and the facts are and to have a decent, honest conversation. Mm-hmm. I think that's caused a lot of acrimony and a lot of the difficulties between people of different ideas, particularly on the president. But I think it's certainly gone too far. And I think McCain and Flake are right that, what stands between us and tyranny in many cases is a free press, and we need to celebrate it. And I don't take his little fake news award very seriously, although you didn't get one, Jim, and I know you're probably smarting over that because your ratings would go through the roof if you did.
Well, yeah, that kind of publicity is what a lot of people would dream of. But in his fake news awards, he noted several media outlets had made mistakes, and that happens in our world as it does in other worlds. But when it happens and people report falsely the news, it contributes to this mantra of fake news. And as we know, most of the news, especially from those who are the gatekeepers in America, most of the news is not fake. It is real, and it is being portrayed as being fake. And one of the stories the president said is fake is the so-called Russian collusion with his campaign last year, and that remains to be determined, whether people close to the president were involved in collusion with Russia. But there was definitely a lot of discussion with people close to the president, then the candidate, and Russian emissaries.
Well, I think it's all going to come down. I think what it's going to come down to is follow the money, and I think that's what Mueller's doing is he's following the money. And it's all going to come down to money laundering, shaky and maybe illegal investments and people covering up for it and the desire to make more money. And I think that that's going to be the Russian story that sends the most people to prison. That's my opinion. I don't think Mueller's going to be spending a whole lot of time before getting back to us. I think things are – I mean, he's gotten so close to the inner circle. I mean, who does he have left to interview? We got Bannon about to be interviewed, and then there's the forays you see in the news about Trump being interviewed. I mean, he's running out of people, and I think he's pretty close to the top. So I think we're looking closer we're getting much closer to this report than we may have thought last year. I think it's coming close.
877-217-5757 is our number, and talk@talklouisiana.org is our email. And in just a bit, we're going to hear from Thomas Galligan, the dean of the LSU Law Center. But Rebecca in Baton Rouge asks about Senator Cassidy, who I heard him. He was quoted as saying that he thought that his Democratic colleague, Dick Durbin of Illinois, made a mistake by coming forward with his report on the president calling some of these countries S-hole countries, saying that there was a private meeting and that Durbin violated the privacy of the meeting. So the question from Rebecca is, Senator Cassidy representing the people, or is he representing the president?
Well, I don't think, by definition, this is a government meeting. It's not a private meeting. I understand the importance of state secrets, and to an extent, I understand that, and I think most reasonable people do believe that there are certain things that should be top secret. This wasn't it. This was a government meeting with a bunch of legislators, and you know, I think it should have been on the record. But instead, it's, you know, he had some kind of a fit, the president did, and said some things he shouldn't have said. And rather than coming out and saying, you know, I shouldn't have said that, like most people would, most reasonable people would do, he evaded and made various attempts to say, rather than to come out and say it didn't happen, because it really did. They did some gymnastics and said it was hard language. Well, he said it, and I'm happy that Durbin went out and said it. If they don't want Durbin in the meetings, then don't invite Durbin to the meeting.
All right, we've got about 30 seconds, Dane, but your thoughts about the prospect of a race next year for governor between the incumbent, John Bel Edwards, who you know well, and John Neely Kennedy, the junior U.S. senator.
I think John Kennedy should probably stay in the Senate, and he should learn from David Vitter, because when John Bel Edwards trounces him in that race, that may be the end of his political career. So I think he probably should stay in Washington, where he seems to fit in, and leave the real governing to the state, to people that know what they're doing, and John Bel Edwards would be an example of that.
Thank you, Dane Sherman. It's been a pleasure. Let's do it again soon.
Thank you, Jim. Enjoy.
We'll be back after this pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana on 89.3 WRKF, 877-217-5757 and 297-5633. Those are your numbers. And if you're inclined to send us an email, we like that as well, talk@talklouisiana.org. In-house is the dean of the LSU Law Center, the Paul M. Hebert Law Center, Tom Galligan, and the law school at LSU is recognized as one of the best in the region, if not the country, and many luminaries in all walks of life, mainly the legal profession, have gone through the doors of the Law Center at LSU, many politicos who we know quite well. Once again, 877-217-5757. A few minutes ago, I said that Thomas Galligan was the new dean. Well, it's been a year and a half. How time flies. Well, it's good to have you with us.
Jim, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And before we get to some of the matters that Dean Galligan is tending to, a note on his background. He is also the former dean of the University of Tennessee College of Law.
Yep.
And I'm sure they have a very good school at Knoxville.
They have a great law school. As I said before we got started, it's the second best law school in the SEC after LSU.
All right. And you taught torts? And
torts, admiralty, various other okay. subjects.
All right.
Still doing it.
And Dean Galligan was the eighth president of Colby Sawyer College. Colby Sawyer College is not an SEC powerhouse, but in the academic world, it's recognized as a good school.
It's a fine school. It's in New London, New Hampshire, which is a city of about 3,000 people. In the winter, more like 2,000. And it got me ready for the last 2 days of cold here in South Louisiana.
Yeah. Well, the law school is closed, but Dean Galligan is here, and he looks fit. And I can tell you're a man of great energy. We're glad you're at the Law Center. And you love baseball.
I am a baseball nut. I absolutely love baseball. I'm a Red Sox fan. And as much as I love baseball, I also love baseball history and everything that has to do with baseball.
Well, I was 9 years old in 1967 when the Red Sox, I think they were ninth the year before, and they went from ninth to first. They won the American League pennant. Should have beaten the Cardinals in the World Series, but lost in seven games. I suspect that made an impression on you. You're a few years older than me, but not many. You remember 1967?
I do remember 1967. I was 12 years old. I was a Yankee fan. And then that summer, we had gone to Cape Cod for vacation. So I spent 2 weeks in a hotel in Cape Cod watching the Red Sox with a bunch of senior citizens.
Oh.
And I became a Kari Yastrzemski fan, and I became a Red Sox fan. And I convinced my mother on Game 7 that I was sick and I should stay home. And it was a rough day. Bob Gibson beat Jim Lomborg.
Bob Gibson was pitching on 3 days rest and Lonborg on two.
Yep.
And Lonborg in that series had pitched a one-hitter. And number 16 for the Red Sox, he went 22-9 in the year of 1967. And Yastrzemski won the Triple Crown.
Yeah, you know your baseball. Yastrzemski won the Triple Crown, and he actually tied for the home run lead with Harmon Killebrew.
44.
But, yeah, you got it, but it still led the league. Bob Gibson was absolutely awesome in that series. Lonborg, I'm a Stanford grad. Lonborg was a Stanford grad as well. And you probably also remember that he did a terrible thing that winter.
Skiing.
With Jill St. John. And
he was dating Jill St. John?
At least he was skiing with her.
he went down for the count.
And he went down for the count. And speaking of Yastrzemski, he was number eight. And I was the eighth president of Colby Sawyer College. And so when I was brought into the office, my vice presidents gave me an autographed baseball by Kari Yastrzemski. So it says number eight on it.
And the Red Sox won the pennant that year by one game over Detroit. And Sox would probably have won by a bigger margin and perhaps would have won the World Series if not for the injury to Tony Conigliaro.
Mm-hmm, who was beaned.
By Jack Hamilton.
Uh-huh.
Not the former Manship Dean, but a different Jack Hamilton.
Different Jack Hamilton.
1967. But enough of baseball. You know your baseball.
Baseball.
We could talk more about that, and I'd like to as we get closer to April. But the Law Center, as I noted, is a treasure in Louisiana, and it is recognized, rightly so, as perhaps the best law school in Louisiana. But yet when I see these U.S. News and World Report rankings, Tulane's always ranked ahead of LSU. Why is that?
Well, you know, Tulane is a great law school, too. For as long as we could talk about baseball, we could talk about U.S. News and World Report rankings. They overemphasize the importance of the LSAT score. They overemphasize the importance of undergraduate grade point average, and they also overemphasize the importance of what they call reputational rankings. I get a survey every year. Every law school dean in America does. Many judges do. Many law professors do, where I get to rate every law school in the United States. Now I know a lot about law schools, probably almost as much as I know about baseball. But I know a lot about law schools, but still, I don't know everything about every law school, and yet I get to rank those law schools. So I would tell anybody who looks at U.S. News and World Report, don't rely on that when you pick a college or a law school. Jim, I sometimes say, I ask my wife, I said, Susan, you've been married to me for 36 years. I said, why'd you marry me? And she sort of put her chin in her hand, and she thought for a minute. She said, you know, there were 44 men in your high school class. I went to an all-male school. She went to the sister school. They're now merged. Yeah. There were 45 men in my class, and I probably knew about 100 other boys. So that's about 200. And I said, yeah, well. She said, you were 61. I said, what do you mean I was 61? She said, you were 61 out of 200. She said, I probably could have gotten to 37 or 38, but you were smart. You were funny. The point is that's not how you pick a partner. That shouldn't be how you pick a school.
Well, I think it was Al McGuire, getting back to sports, who said the guy who finishes last in med school still has a name. They call him Doctor.
That is exactly right.
But Tulane is ranked high, and it's a good school.
It's
but
a great school.
But I'm not sure it's any better than LSU. And a lot of the students at Tulane come from other parts of the United States. How many of your members of the student body at the law school at LSU are homegrown?
About 75%. I think in this year's first-year class, 74% of the class come from Louisiana, and then about 80% of our graduates stay in Louisiana. Some of the folks who come from somewhere else stay. Some of the folks who come from Louisiana go. But predominantly, we are right here in Louisiana making a positive impact, as are the other law schools, but making a real positive impact on the law and business and politics in our state.
And you mentioned politics. I know people who've gone through the doors of the LSU Law Center who are very liberal and some who are very conservative. There is no real distinction. You can't say that you're going to get this kind of a person coming out of your school.
That's exactly right. We try to be balanced, and the people that come in are balanced, and the people that go out are balanced.
In the old days, when I graduated from LSU in '81, I thought about going to law school, but I heard that half the class flunked out the first year, and that was true. Is that the case any longer?
That is no longer the case. It is one harder to get into the LSU Law Center
harder
than it was back then. And our attrition rate, I was here from 1986 to 1998, and our attrition rate in those years was about 33 1/3%. Today, it is less than 5%. So they used to say, look to the left, look to the right. In a year, none of you are going to be here. I said to the first year class this year, look to the left, look to the right. What you see is a person you'll probably be practicing law with for the rest of your career.
95% of the students now survive. But in the 80s, I think it was a 50% attrition rate.
There were years where it was close to 50, and it was certainly a third was standard.
A third when you were there from 86 to 98.
Yeah.
So it's because it's harder to get in, and now you have to score pretty well on the LSAT, have good grades, and be a good citizen.
And I think we're a much more supportive place than we were at that time. We try to identify folks who are going to have difficulties or challenges earlier on and give them the resources they need to succeed.
Well, we're visiting with Thomas Galligan, the Dean of the Paul M. Hebert Law Center at LSU, and we'll talk with him about what's going on in the legal world. And if you have a question that you'd like to pose to Dean Galligan, 877-217-5757 or 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. And you can send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. We're back after this brief timeout for Karen Henderson and the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757. You're listening to Talk Louisiana on 89.3 WRKF. Our local dial is 297-5633, and you can send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. Thomas Galligan is with us for another segment. He is the dean of the Paul M. Hebert Law Center at LSU, standing tall and proud the old war school right by the parade grounds. And today, if you go by LSU, you're not going to see many people because the school is closed. But Dean Galligan is here, and he is ready to talk with us. Candace in Sherwood Forest. Hi, Candace. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Hi, how are you? This is your student, Dean Galligan. Candace, you're my tort professor.
Candace, how are you?
I'm doing so well. I was so excited when I heard you. I was like, oh, my gosh, my dean is on the radio. And I just want to let you know, I'm so proud of you. I'm proud of LSU. You are a great professor and a wonderful dean. And I do have a question. It's since I'm a representative on the Diversity and Professionalism Committee for SBA, I wanted to know what ideas you have about increasing diversity at the Law Center, because we get a lot of flack from the other law school in town for maybe not being as diverse. And I want to actually work on that and see how we can make the law center more diverse.
Well, Candace, thank you for calling. You're a great law student. Candace usually sat in the back and took everything in, and she did great. Well, Candace, I share your passion and enthusiasm for making the law center even more diverse and even more inclusive than it is today. I think one thing that we can certainly do is that we can let folks know what a supportive and diverse and inclusive environment we have. We can continue to invite the community. Jim, we've had a series of dialogues on difficult conversations about. We've talked about difficult conversations about race, difficult conversations about gender, difficult conversations about sexual orientation. Because we're a supportive community and we want to be able to talk openly and be who we are. So Candace, certainly we can do that. I think we can also continue to look at resources that we can devote to increasing our student diversity, our faculty and staff diversity, and to show the world how inclusive we are. And I would certainly be interested in your ideas and the ideas of other students.
Right now, as far as minority representation, what is it on a percentage at LSU's Law Center?
In the first year class, I think the percentage of minorities was self-identified, and that's just one measure, was about 20%. with the African-American population, I think, was 13%.
Okay. 877-217-5757. Still time to talk with Dean Thomas Galligan of the LSU Law Center. Dan downtown. Hi, Dan. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Yeah, Dean Galligan, is there any concern at the law school about the state of justice for employees claiming sex harassment or discrimination because of race, sex, or disability? Statistical studies at Cornell, Harvard, and the University of Illinois show that the U.S. Fifth Circuit only reverses 4% of trial court decisions for employers, but reverses 60% of decisions for employees.
I was not aware of that statistic, so I'm certainly interested, and thank you for pointing that out. I think we're interested in justice for all, and whatever the issue may be, Dan. So certainly, yeah, we're interested in those issues and thoughtful about them.
Thank you, Dan. 877-217-5757 and talk@talklouisiana.org. That's the way to reach Dean Galligan in our remaining time. Do you have, David in St. Francisville asked, do you have an opinion about lawyer advertising?
Well, my opinion about it is that it's protected by the First Amendment. And so lawyers like doctors and like others have the right to advertise. Certainly would say we see an awful lot of it.
Well, is it dignified, or in some cases is it over the top, in your judgment?
You know, I think in some cases it can get over the top. But I would point out that lawyers have been advertising for a long, long time. They've been doing it at college reunions. They've been doing it at golf clubs. And what we've seen in the past 30 or 40 years is just a much more public aspect to that advertising. Like anything, my taste may be different than someone else's. And you talked about balance before. I think you got to find a balance between information and dignified speech.
Eric on Millerville. Eric, you're on Talk Louisiana with Dean Thomas Galligan.
Yeah, constitutional question. In the writing of the Constitution, did the writers have the view that the Constitution should be followed strictly, or did they, in their writing, understand it as a living document to be interpreted by the society as time went on? I've heard both sides argued, and I appreciate your opinion.
Yeah, and I think you can make pretty strong arguments for both sides. The Constitution, Eric, it's Eric, right?
Yes.
Was not written by one person. It was written by a group of men. They were all men at the time. And then whose opinion do we care about? Do we care about the people who wrote it? Do we care about the people who ratified it? Or do we care about the conventions that ratified it? So, Eric, it's a deep, complicated historical question to which I think there is probably no one right answer.
Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court often has justices with different opinions about that. And the High Court, as a listener notes, is congregated almost exclusively by Ivy League graduates. I think there's one Stanford grad on there other than the Ivy Leaguers, that being Justice Kennedy. Is that unfortunate? Like, for example, you're probably never going to find a Supreme Court justice in our lifetime who's a graduate of the LSU Law Center. Are we missing out by not having representation from other parts of the country?
I think absolutely. We also see that while they come from different backgrounds, while they're men and women, while they have different ethnic or racial backgrounds, they're all coming from elite law schools, having received elite law school educations. So I think that's one point we make. Another is that each and every one of them, before going to the Supreme Court, was a federal appellate judge. Over the course of our nation's history, we've had folks who were senators. We've had folks who were governors. We've had an experiential diversity that we lack now as well. So I think we are missing something, yes.
I remember when Bill Clinton was president, he tried to coax Mario Cuomo into going on the Supreme Court. And I think it's unfortunate that Governor Cuomo didn't take him up. He would have been an eloquent voice.
Yeah. Hugo Black, of course, was a senator from Alabama.
Yes.
Earl Warren was the governor of California. Yeah. So we've seen a diversity we don't see right now.
Now, two LSU Law Center graduates, Kyle Duncan and Kurt Engelhardt, were nominated to the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. And some people may not like their politics, but that's what we were getting at, is that LSU produces people on all sides of the political spectrum. And these two people, one a 1997 graduate, Duncan, and the other a 1985 graduate, Engelhardt, who currently is chief judge of the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Louisiana, they're an example of people from the Law Center going to high places.
Yeah, we're very proud of both of them. We talk about different folks across the political spectrum. Governor John Bel Edwards, of course, is also a graduate of the LSU Law Center.
He is, and he's one of those people who went to law school in his late 20s, early 30s. He did his stint in the military, and he came back and got a law degree. And I think if you were to ask him about what he's doing now, that's probably influenced his work as governor and as a state lawmaker before, more so than anything else he's done.
Yeah. Well, he was actually in the last admiralty course that I
taught at
LSU before I went to Tennessee.
Do you recall him as a student?
I do. He's absolutely one of my favorite students.
And Mike Johnson, who's been with us, a congressman from Shreveport, has noted he was a law school classmate of Governor Edwards.
Uh-huh.
And he, of course, is a very conservative lawmaker. Now, what about and a listener asked this, and I don't know if you want to bite on this, but the constitutional crisis we had in 1973 when we had the so-called Saturday Night Massacre, in which President Nixon ultimately got the Solicitor General Robert Bork to fire Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor, when two other people refused to do so. We could be, some believe, headed for some sort of a case like this now. What would that do as far as the legal establishment in this country if the Attorney General, for example, who's recused himself, the Assistant Attorney General refused to do what the President asked him to do?
Well, I think that what happened in 73 history can repeat itself, is that we lost a lot of confidence in our government after those events, after the whole Watergate crisis. Legal ethics is now a required course in every ABA-accredited law school, and it wasn't like that before Watergate. So I do think we learn from these things, but we also suffer from them.
Well, we're going to spend a few more minutes with Thomas Galligan, the LSU Law Center Dean, and then he'll be off to the races. Perhaps literally, you've run how many marathons?
I've run 24. I haven't done one in a few years.
24. What's your best time?
3:29.
That's moving.
It was 8 minutes a mile.
That is moving. I was 3:29.
Yeah, yeah. I was 39 years old. My daughter Sarah, who actually turns 31 today, it's her birthday. She was born in Baton Rouge. She no longer lives here, but she's beaten that time by several seconds. And I tell her she had a chip and I didn't, so we're tied. But 3:29 was my fastest.
I know the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, he got in some trouble a few years ago saying that he had run a sub-4-hour marathon, and it turned out it was a sub-5-hour marathon. There's a big difference, isn't
there? There is. With the Blue Angel Marathon, you can look it up.
3:29 for Thomas Galligan, 877-217-5757. We're back after this timeout with more Talk Louisiana right here on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And coming in just a moment, we're going to hear from the best-selling author Daniel Pink. And he is back in a huge way. We're finishing up with this effervescent gentleman, Thomas Galligan, who's dean of the LSU Law Center. And before we part company, you mentioned you thought the LSU Law Center was the best in the Southeastern Conference. Were you just blowing smoke, or do you really think that?
No, I really do think that. We have an absolutely fantastic faculty. Our students it's a beehive of activity. They're engaged. They're involved. They give back. Our public interest law students group does pro bono work. They do community service. We've got some wonderful clinics, great externships, great alums. And we're also the only SEC law school that's in a jurisdiction that is both common law and civil law. We're what we call bi-jural. So you're learning about both of the world's great legal systems in one wonderful place, Louisiana, and we have the best food and the most wonderful people.
That helps. Thank you very much, Dean Galligan. Good to see you, and let's do it again soon.
Thank you very much.
And now we're joined by Daniel Pink. He's an author of several best-selling books and is back in a huge way with When, the Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. And it is fortunate for us that his time is with us right now. If you'd like to join our conversation with Daniel Pink, 877-217-5757. Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. And you believe fervently that there are essential keys to timing our decisions and actions that we can help us thrive, both personally and professionally. What can we do?
Well, what we can do is we can take actually these questions of timing, Jim, more seriously. You know, what I discovered in doing this research is that timing, which we tend to think of as an art, we tend to make the decisions in haphazard, intuitive ways based on gut instinct. Timing is really a science. There's a wide body of research out there that if we go into it, we can make systematically better decisions about when to do things. So when in the day should we do certain kinds of work? When in the day should we exercise? When in a project should we abandon it? When should we really get going on a project? And what I'm hoping here in this book is to give people the scientific background to allow them to make better, smarter, shrewder timing decisions in their own life.
Well, it's a fascinating book, and it goes into a lot of depth in many areas. For example, you say that sports teams that are slightly behind at halftime are more likely to win.
Yeah, no, it's pretty amazing. This is some research out of by Jonah Berger at Penn, University of Pennsylvania, Devin Pope at University of Chicago, looking at both NBA games and NCAA basketball games. And what they found was that, in general, teams that are ahead at halftime are more likely to win the game. Makes perfect sense, right? The game's half over and you've got a lead. But there was an exception to that, and that was when teams were down by 1 point at halftime. They were actually more likely to win. Being down by 1 point was equivalent to being ahead by 2 points. And there's something about, and there's other research on this as well, there's something about at a midpoint, if we feel like we're slightly behind, that sparks our motivation, gets us to work a little bit harder and come back strong in the second half.
And I've been under the impression throughout my life, Daniel, that breakfast was the most important meal of the day. You say it's not.
Well, I don't think the science says that, actually, that it is. I think the science is pretty mixed on that. It doesn't say that breakfast is bad for you, that you shouldn't have breakfast, not at all. But the idea that it's essential, that it's the most important meal of the day, is a little bit questionable. What the research does show is that, basically, that breakfast is less important than we think, but lunch is more important than we think. And that lunch has, especially when we take a lunch away from our desk, use it as part of a break, that lunches can be incredibly restorative and help us combat the mid-afternoon trough.
Now, a nap might help. I've heard this. For example, Ronald Reagan took naps. Many other presidents have as well. What kind of a nap, though? Should we sleep 3 or 4 hours in the afternoon?
Probably not a great idea unless you're, 18 months old. What it shows is, first of all, that naps are extremely beneficial to us, but we can get more bang for our buck by napping correctly. And what we can do is that short naps are much more effective than we think. So a nap of even, 10, 20 minutes long is incredibly effective. The problem with longer naps is that when you wake up from it, you feel groggy. That's what researchers call sleep inertia. With a 10 or 20 minute nap, you get the benefits of a nap that lasts for, really as long as 3 hours, but without the sleep inertia. So there is an ideal kind of nap, very short. There's even a way to even turbocharge it. It sounds a little bit peculiar, but what I do is I have a cup of coffee first. Okay, this sounds weird, right before a nap. Then I will set my phone timer, countdown timer, for 23 minutes. I will put on my headphones. I will kick back in a chair, and I will try to go to sleep. And I can usually fall asleep in, say, 7 or 8 minutes. the alarm goes off at 23 minutes, so I slept for maybe 15 minutes. And then the great part, though, is remember that cup of coffee. Caffeine takes about 25 minutes to hit the bloodstream. So when I'm waking up, refreshed from that nap, I get the second boost of energy from the caffeine. This is something that people call a nappuccino.
Nappuccino. I love it. The book is When, and that's all caps, W-H-E-N, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. You say that in the afternoon we should never have surgery and never take a standardized test. Why?
Well, I mean, what the research shows is that let's take surgery for instance. There are four times as many anesthesia errors at 3 p.m. as there are at 9 a.m. Hand washing in hospitals deteriorates significantly in the afternoon compared to the morning. Endoscopists find fewer polyps in colonoscopies in afternoon exams versus the morning exams. So there's a big effect in the afternoon for healthcare. Same as seems to be true for education. There's a good research out of Denmark on standardized tests that shows that students score systematically lower when they take a test in the afternoon. Taking a standardized test in the afternoon is equivalent to missing 2 weeks of school. And there's research out of LA, Los Angeles, showing that that students learn more when they have math class in the morning versus the afternoon. They have higher grades, higher test scores. And again, as we were talking earlier, you know, schools are very deliberate about, you know, what do we teach and who's going to teach it and how do we teach it. But they give short shrift to the question of when, and it makes a big difference in how much students learn, how well they perform.
You've gone through 500 million tweets. I assume that you've had a little help in doing this.
I didn't go through those tweets. Researchers at Cornell did, and what they found is this very predictable pattern of people's mood. We had to end up with sort of a rising mood in the morning, declining mood in the early afternoon, and then rising mood again late in the afternoon and early evening. And that pattern of peak trough recovery is pretty common, and it affects our mood, it affects our performance. And you know, in the workplace, if we can just move around what we do to certain times of the day, we're going to perform at a higher level.
So the ideal work schedule would be what?
Well, it depends on who you are. You know, what we should do, most of us move through the day in that order, peak, trough, recovery. Now, for people who are night owls, which is about 20% of us, they go through in the reverse order. But during the peak, we should be doing our analytic work, the heads-down, focused work that requires vigilance. During the trough, early afternoon, mid-afternoon, we should be doing our administrative stuff, things that don't require a lot of brain power. And then during the recovery, it actually, because we have an elevated mood and because we're a little bit looser, that ends up being a very interesting time to do, effective time to do creative kinds of work. And again, you know, what the research shows is that the time of day explains about 20% of the variance in how people perform at work. So it doesn't mean timing is everything, but 20% means it's a really big thing.
You also go into whether it's better to deliver bad news or good news during a job performance review, at least to start things off. Which is better?
Well, I mean, what I always would do, you know, everybody says I got good news and bad news. And what I always did is I gave the good news first to cushion the blow, to ease into things. And it turns out that's wrong. 4 out of 5 people, according to the research, want the bad news first. And the reason for that is that, in general, we prefer endings that elevate. And so you're typically better off in a good news, bad news situation, giving the bad news first and then the good news, because human beings prefer endings with rising sequences rather than declining sequences.
And we want to, of course, at times start anew. You say there's some days that are better to do this than others.
Sure. Like New Year's Day is a typical fresh start day. But there are certain days of the year that take advantage of what some researchers call the fresh start effect, where like a business opens up a fresh ledger in a new quarter or a new year. We do that mentally for ourselves. And so so you're more likely to say be successful in starting a new diet or a new exercise plan if you start it on a Monday rather than a Thursday. Mondays are fresh start dates. On the first of a month rather than the 18th of a month. If
gotcha.
You do it the day after your birthday rather than the day before your birthday. What we're doing is essentially opening up fresh ledgers on ourselves, saying, you know, terrible me didn't exercise, but new me born again on this Monday is going to do better.
And thanks for listening.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a